Welcome to a talk on prosthetics by Megan Katz, inspired by an artist's work that we have up currently up in the space just behind you, this two-channel video installation by Anna Hawkins. Thank you so much for coming. It's a great crowd. We're excited to have Megan in the space and share her expertise with us. My name is Penelope Smart. I'm the director of Eastern Edge Gallery. And Eastern Edge Gallery, for anyone who doesn't know, is the only artist-run center in Newfoundland and Labrador dedicated to contemporary art practice. So it's really wonderful that you are here and taking part in events like these that broaden our understanding of the art in the space and engage with local expertise on various subjects and careers. So it's wonderful. We'd love to keep having more events like this. If anyone's not a member, I encourage you to check us out online, or you can sign up. There's a little sign-up sheet there to find out more about becoming a member. It's $25 a year, or $15 for students, so it's a really good deal. And if you're just interested in kind of getting to know the space a little more before you commit, you can get our weekly newsletter, which is a great roundup of like everything that we're doing and things that are happening across the island, art-wise, contemporary art-wise. And that's just an email away for you. On that list. So without further ado, let's get to the fun stuff. Megan Katz is a prosthetic technician with a BFA in jewelry design and metalsmithing from NASCAD University. Her work and research centers around metaphoric and physical extensions of the body and reimagines the human form in relation to the tactility of prosthetic devices and jewelry. Give it up for Megan Katz.
Thank you guys so much for coming out tonight. And thank you everyone at Eastern Edge and to Penny and Chloe for inviting me here to chat tonight. I think this evening is going to be a little bit of a smorgasbord of just different ideas and thoughts and images that I sort of come across in my day-to-day work and things that have still carried over from doing my BFA in Halifax. And then also, I guess I'll throw some thoughts out about the work that's on display right now. So Anna Hawkins, How to Chop an Onion. I'm originally from Toronto, and I was pretty fortunate to have gone through an art school from grade 4 to 12, which I'm realizing sort of plays into my life in more ways than I ever could have thought possible. So I thought, you know, it's a natural progression to continue with art school. So I ended up in Halifax, where there are also very beautifully colored, bright houses. And while I was there, I always knew I kind of wanted to get into sculpture, but I didn't know about jewelry making at all. And so it was a bit of a toss-up when I was thinking about what major I wanted to go into. But there was something that really appealed to me with jewelry making, with learning traditions that had been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. So at school, I was learning really old school traditional techniques. We did hollowware, which is forming vessels out of metal. We did stone setting, enameling, all of that kind of stuff. But luckily, there was a real contemporary approach to the work as well. So we were pushed to work in alternative materials and work on, just throwing weird things in there. So if we're working with paper or concrete, and also different techniques like electroforming or, really whatever you could come up with. So something about jewelry too that I loved was the scale of it. It's sort of small, it's sort of precious, and it always has this inherent link to the body. You know, jewelry is always meant to be worn and adorn the body. But, you know, we were definitely pushed to question that. So I was thinking, you know, just about how to make jewelry in this broader art context and always going back to the body sort of as a source of inspiration. And I don't know, maybe that was linked to just watching way too much open heart surgery on TV as a kid, like just something about it like just kept calling to me. So this was one piece that I had done using that electroforming technique. So it's actually sort of growing, if you will, copper over organic shapes. I think I used, you know, balloons or something like that. It's coated with wax and there's some pearl set on the inside. So, you know, thinking about our, you know, bringing the inside out of the body. So looking at our organs and our viscera and all of these sort of gross things we don't think about, you know, what happens when that's now out there for everybody to see? And also questioning, like, why jewelry always has to be something that's pretty or beautiful. So this was a brooch that's made out of silver and masking tape, and there's actually a little diamond set on the inside of a silver piece there. So drawing from the skeletal system, thinking about sort of the fragility, but also the strength of our bodies, and also playing with contrasting materials and what is the value of our health, perhaps, or of jewelry in itself. So these were 7 spoons that I had made, thinking about sharing taste with somebody else. So now, you know, going back to objects and really wanting to play with interacting with someone when I can't physically be there. So I had cast the roof of my mouth and then had that as the underneath of the spoon and forged the handles so that when somebody else, you know, is theoretically using this spoon, they're almost tasting what I taste. So I like to play with that sort of sensory and also social aspect and, you know, what happens when something as private as my mouth is now put out in public and sort of, you know, throwing off these everyday objects as well. These are a couple little pendants. They're only about an inch big, actually, called pinch for obvious reasons. You know, I think trying to entice a specific action to me was interesting, and wondering, you know, if you have this pendant around you, like, how are you interacting with it, and when would you use it? And then also, you know, is somebody going to find that satisfying or maybe a bit strange or awkward? But why does a ring necessarily even have to be on your finger in the first place? So, you know, using sort of the language of sculpture, I set 4 rings onto a plinth and they're all adjustable. But now I'm sort of asking somebody to approach the work and bring the body to the jewelry, as it were. So, you know, on one hand, it's also limiting how you can move and interact with the piece, but you're kind of rewarded with a sense of rest once you get there. And that kind of led to, this was my final grad exhibition while I was at school. So it's actually a full wall that I had built into sort of an alcove space in the Annalyn Owens Gallery. And each one of those forms are handmade in copper and then coated in a white plastic and inset into that wall. So it's sort of a sterile, kind of all white on white, medical aesthetic. The piece actually is called dysesthesia, so thinking about an abnormal sense of touch. I think I was, you know, at that point definitely still looking at prosthetic devices and, you know, phantom limb was something that always circled around my head. Like, it was pretty cool, right? Like, you're feeling something from a limb or from a part that's no longer there. So going on that memory and that sense of something that once was, I'm asking you to sort of lean into these spaces and put yourself, I guess, where I once was. And you're almost given a sense of humanness or of heat because there's coiled wire behind each one of those pieces. So you're actually feeling a sense of actual heat that's there. So it's kind of like when you're sitting on the bus and, you know, somebody was there before you and you still feel that warm seat and it's like a little uncomfortable, but it's kind of nice. Like, it's
pre-warmed for you?
I guess that was sort of what I was going with in a very roundabout kind of way. But you know, what next? So I finished school, and I think I asked what everybody asks is, what the hell do I do now? So I had applied for a residency at the Harbourfront Centre, which is a craft residency in Toronto, because, you know, well, of course, you got to keep making work. But at that time, I also, you know, was questioning what else I wanted to do. And I had a conversation with a really dear friend and teacher of mine. And she just said, you know, Megan, like, you keep coming back to these medical devices and you keep thinking about them and they're sort of playing a part in all the work that you make. Like, why don't you just go and make them? And it was like, oh, right, that makes a lot of sense. So the idea was definitely planted in my brain at that point in time, but I was accepted into the Harbourfront residency, so I thought, okay, I'm not going to pass up an opportunity like that. So I continued with sort of, you know, looking at medical illustrations, for one, and this was, I guess, the least kind of grotesque one that I could find, in case anyone was a little squeamish in the audience. But I found that they have sort of this sense of grace and elegance. And, you know, there was one that I came across with a woman with her hair still braided and her arm extended and all of her skin and muscles just splayed open. And I thought, well, that's quite awful and terrible. And you're manipulating the body and pulling it apart and stretching it. But ultimately, it is to learn more about it. So I did a little exhibition there with, they're all hand-formed ceramic pieces with some metal elements to them as well. Just, you know, looking at how we analyze ourselves, maybe going back to bringing that inside out and bringing some kind of grace or elegance to this, I guess, destruction in a way. So that was in three vitrine spaces, and I really loved that you could sort of peer in and have a look at these objects. So I spent a year at the Harbourfront, and after that, I actually found out that I was accepted to George Brown for the prosthetics and orthotics school, because I was applying to that at the same time as the residency. It's a little bit crazy. But I got in, so I thought, you know what, let's try this prosthetics thing. This is not mine, but this I thought was a fun maquette that I came across. It's called, you know, For a Horse with No Legs. So going in with, you know, no anatomy, no biomechanics, nothing, you know, sort of practical, I went for it anyways. And a few of my friends were saying, you know, well, like, you did jewelry, you know, you worked with your hands, that should help you out a little bit. But like, no. Not really. So I was now working, you know, in a totally different scale. I was working with completely new materials. You know, instead of our like 0.7 millimeter drill bits, we're now using, you know, proper ones that you buy in the, you know, the Canadian Tire. But the biggest thing for me was now having to prioritize function over form. So I couldn't just make whatever I wanted and put a pin back on it. You know, not that jewelry can't be well or, you know, poorly made, but, you know, you're learning how to make a medical device. And that, for me, I think was the biggest shift in making. So I was looking for work after 2 years of school, and with no mortgage and no kids and sort of no real excuse, I came out to work at the Miller Center. So what do I actually do? Which, you know, funny enough, the How It's Made video on prosthetics, not super informative. So basically what we do is when somebody is ready to be fit for a prosthetic, they're going to be assessed by a clinician, and then a cast is usually made of the residual limb. So we fill that cast with plaster, and then that can be modified in order to relieve areas that could be sensitive or to add pressure to areas that are tolerant to that. And then we would make a trial device. So it would look, you know, maybe something like this. So that's sort of our quick and dirty plastic socket. So it's clear, it's easy to see what's going on with their skin underneath. You can adjust it with a heat gun. And, you know, beneath the socket, which is custom to their leg, it's basically just Lego. So it's, you know, different pieces that can be shifted and slided and tilted so that we can make that leg fit that person the best. So they would go home on it, test it out for a little while. We can make some adjustments if we need to. And then we'd move on to the laminated socket. So the plastic being draped under a vacuum is the image on the left there. And then the image on the right is resin being poured over different types of material like carbon fiber or fiberglass and different, like nylon, for example, to make their final device. And then it's all assembled. There might be straps that are added to it. And also a lot of physiotherapy that would go along to help that person readjust to their life before their amputation. So this is, you know, definitely a team effort, and it involves a lot of trial and error. I thought this was a really nice little box of treasures I came across in the lab for somebody with a partial hand device. And, you know, we have to just problem solve and problem solve and problem solve. So it's a lot of adjustments and it's a lot of repairs because the body is just always changing and your needs are always going to change as well. So another big thing working in this industry now was I sure as hell can't be precious about my work anymore. Because, I mean, when I was in school, like, I mean, this was probably the first image that I came across of prosthetic legs. So these are actually glass, and it's a still frame from a video by the artist Matthew Barney called The Cremaster Cycle. It's a really long and sort of convoluted film. If you have time one day, I guess, watch it if you like. But, you know, these kinds of devices, which I think are absolutely fascinating, like, are not for everybody. In fact, they're for hardly anyone at all, because the truth is that most of the patients that we work with are going to be geriatric and usually a diabetic patient as well. So, you know, they want something that's going to be safe, that's going to be comfortable, and generally it's something to fill out the rest of their pants. So, you know, we go with our Caucasian pigment, and we can shape their limb to resemble the other side. We can, you know, coat it if we need to and help protect it. But, you know, that's sort of the day in and day out, the sort of bread and butter, if you will. But we do have different colored pigments, and there's t-shirts that we can incorporate to add pattern or to add, a little more color. But, I mean, my favorite is to try and just get a mood across. So if you want a leg to look sick, quote from someone that we work with, like, we can do that, which was for the leg on the left there. And then another fun little project that I was fortunate enough to get on my plate was just this, a little bit hard to see, but it was a leather cuff to basically fill in the space that's missing below the socket and above the foot, because this person just didn't want to have a gap when she wore skinny jeans and leggings. You know, so if I can do something that's pretty simple at the end of the day, but that is going to allow her to just continue with her lifestyle and do the same thing that she was doing before, like, that's something that makes me feel really good and really excited. But there are a couple other options. So you can have silicone devices, which we don't make here in the province, but would be done at a facility out in Ontario. But I just love that they can really match every tone in your skin. They can implant veins and hair and nails, and they're absolutely gorgeous and incredibly expensive. I mean, you can't even really tell the difference. But, you know, it's still not gonna breathe. And it's still not going to feel, and it's not going to change color when you're cold or when you're warm, you know. And I think as incredible and as beautiful as these objects are, you know, it's still trying to be something that it will never be, you know. But, you know, why not customize it? We can modify our bodies. Why not modify prosthetic devices? you know, exploring style, I think, is something that we're now getting into and we're now starting to see in the market. So, for example, a cover over the prosthetic leg there, it still has a bit of form. It's going to fill out a pair of pants, but it totally expresses whatever this guy wants it to express. Adding a bit of color and a bit of, I guess, energy and something to his outfit. I was actually able to hear the two designers that work for the Alels, the company that makes these devices, at a conference in Halifax a couple years ago. And one thing I really loved about what they're trying to do is trying to take stigma away from prosthetic devices. So, you know, just in the way that glasses have become, you know, the epitome of style and, you know, almost intelligence in a weird way, you know, like, why can't we do the same thing for a leg? So, you know, taking the doctor out of the equation, these are actually, you can just order them online. I mean, they do still have to be fit and adjusted, so we end up seeing them in the lab anyways. But I just thought that's a really nice way, and it's also a much more affordable option. But can we go even further than that? What if we see influence from nature? This was a prototype by an industrial designer using sort of a simple cable pulley system. Obviously, you know, kind of this octopus-like tentacle, you know, which is still keeping in mind function, but isn't just trying to mimic what's already been there. I think it's kind of hard because I come across these images. I was able to email correspondence with her back and forth a little bit, and there's all these amazing ideas, but nothing is actually being sort of trickled down yet to the patient. Like, there's so many advances in technology. You know, we're seeing a lot of 3D printing, we're seeing, you know, even crazy surgeries being done to move nerves around to be able to feel through prosthetic devices. There's even being research done to implant metal rods directly into bone to be able to suspend a device. But it's just, it's not there, unfortunately, and it's just not accessible yet. But, you know, some people are getting away with it. So I actually came across this yesterday. This designer in the UK is writing a book called How I Took a Holiday from Being Human, and he decided that he wanted to be a goat. He clearly had a lot of money and a lot of time to be able to do that, and a nice little, you know, biomedical research group supporting him. But he worked with a prosthetic clinician to be able to develop these devices and extend his own body and change his posture entirely just to graze across the Alps for 6 days. Yeah, I kind of wonder if, you know, when this came through the lab, somebody thought, you know, we have a lot of patients waiting. Don't have time for this right now. And apparently for him, it was also a psychological investigation. And he did eat grass for 6 days and went all out. Anyways, people are a little nuts. Moving on, you know, screw nature. Like, let's go somewhere totally different with it. So Victoria Modesta, who is a Latvian pop singer and model, wanted the ultimate stiletto. I think she kind of achieved it. you know, can she walk on it? Not really. But does that really matter in this case? I don't even think so. You know, to be able to maybe go back to sacrificing function a little bit, but to create form that's going to change the body in this way, like, I think that proves a pretty interesting point. Sorry, terrible pun right there. And in her latest music video, where she's wearing this leg, she actually does quite an interesting sort of dance sequence with it. And she also makes a point in her music videos to not always have a prosthetic device on. And that, to me, I think is actually really awesome for just sort of body positivity and having the confidence to just show herself as is with nothing on at all. And she does wear very little clothing on top of that. And, you know, I think there is a whole, you know, maybe enough information for another talk about, you know, prosthetics and sort of the cyborg and the robotic side of it. I'm not going to delve into that because it's just too much for me. But that is also something that's becoming more and more interesting is like, you know, our cell phones are essentially part of us as it is. So why not have, you know, more and more electronic and non sort of human pieces part of us anyways. But, you know, if you haven't had time, there's Anna's exhibition on behind you. And I was able to listen to her speak a couple weeks ago, which I thought was really nice to hear how she came across her video work. And one thing that stood out for me was the limitations that she had actually initially put on herself. So being the way that she would choose specific ways to edit videos or limit where her sources were coming from. And limitations is something I think we definitely come across day to day. You know, wanting always the best for the patient and wanting to make something that's going to be durable and lightweight and cosmetic and quick and adjustable and all of these things all at the same time. And ultimately having to make sacrifices, but learning where that's not going to hurt. And kind of just always wanting to have it all and really pushing to do something is I think what keeps every day a little bit different. So, and I think that in this case with Anna's videos, it also was a way to create new work and new imagery. And I think about, you know, when something familiar is now put in a different context. So something as simple as fingers on a mug, when you're only expecting your own there, you're now interacting with this object in a different way. So, you know, when I see these videos, I'm seeing a lot of the body being isolated and fragmented and collaged back in on itself, but it's also being reduced to just what's there. So, you know, the hands for me really stood out as something that's super expressive. And they're now also, like, becoming just like almost people in themselves. So I don't know, there's something I find almost kind of suggestive with the gestures that you're seeing in the videos. And I kind of think like, okay, so then could these objects and prosthetic devices stand alone as well? And like what happens when they're not being worn and they're just existing kind of on their own? And this was a newer artist that I came across, Heidi Alonzo, and she does work in sort of just jewelry and sculpture, but I like that there's also something sort of poetic about her work too. So I think ultimately also looking at what Anna was doing with different sourcing from, she used DIY videos that she found on YouTube for a lot of it. You know, we're just trying to take from what we know and take from what's available to us. And sometimes we have to add in something of ourselves. So she had some of her own imagery incorporated into the video. But you know, it's a big hodgepodge. And definitely the prosthetic industry, what I've known, and I've only been working for 2 years, is that we pull from whatever and wherever we can. If you did carpentry, if you were a bike mechanic, if you, you know, just knew one of the old guys in the shop back in the day, you know, you would pick their brain for whatever they had. And all of it somehow is going to trickle down into what you're making. So, you know, at the end, if we can just find a way to put it all back together, and then if someone else can benefit from that, you know, if it's in a really straightforward way or something that is a little bit, you know, more out there or a little bit more emotional or poetic, then I think that's a pretty exciting thing. So thank you very much. Also, I brought in a couple different samples, so please feel free to poke around. They're not super fragile, as long as they don't go missing. And ask me questions and bug me. And thanks again.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, questions.
Actually, I'll start things off. I had one about when you were talking about, you know, know, we can make it look so close to the real thing. You know, we have the image of the 2 feet.
Yeah.
But it's still not going to breathe. Like, it's still not alive.
Yeah.
And there's so much interest right now in contemporary art with the aliveness of objects. So when you kind of were mentioning, like, oh, well, what do these, you know, like, plastic limbs and sort of, like, things that we built in the shop, like, what do they become when they're not in use for what they were made for, when they're not attached to an arm or a leg? Like, what is their aliveness? And I'm wondering if you, just in your conversations I've worked with your patients, like, what is the tipping point for them when their fake arm or leg becomes, like, alive? Like, when does it become, like, their iPhone? Like, when it's part of them?
Right.
What, do you have stories about that?
Yeah. Well, okay, so I should have also clarified that I don't work with patients directly.
Okay.
But, I mean, Kate, who is a clinician and my lovely coworker, and Ulrika, who is my technical supervisor. I don't know, Kate, do you have something in terms of, like, feedback from patients? Because I would say, like, I can't speak for them,
Yeah. You
know, so I mean, I guess I have my own idea once it, like, leaves the shop, but I mean, have you ever come across anything, Kate?
Not directly, and I think that that's something that we're lacking, because really what we're trying to do is replace something that's missing so somebody becomes functional, and very few people think of it in an art and aesthetic sense, so there's so much space for that to bringing motion and movement and aliveness into the devices in the future. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I guess, like, the reality of the need that's being addressed, unfortunately doesn't necessarily, like, span this conversation necessarily. Like, I think that we can bring options and we can try to influence them to even have, like, different colors and things, but I think sometimes it's more about just wanting to have a wholeness again and less so thinking it in a way of, like, an art context that, like, maybe that's where you're coming from. Does that make sense?
Yeah, or, like, even, you know, like, even people have, like, I mean, people being baseball bats. Like, like, people being, like, what does it become, or how does it become, or, like, is there a specific thing about it, or after a certain amount of time being used, does it become, like, a real part of them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's really dependent on the person. I mean, I don't know. I've come across some, like, fairly enthusiastic people come through who, you know, have some ideas and they, like, want, you know, a specific thing done, or they will even try to modify their leg themselves, which is not always a good idea. You know, because, yeah, of course there's ownership. And you know, I think there's definitely people who, like, I don't know. I don't know if they purely see that just as function, but I think they see it in a way that, like, it's still, there's still things that they, like, care about and take care of. But that's not everyone either. Yeah.
Thank you.
Cool. That's a good question. Yeah.
Good question. So growing the cost of prosthetic legs, would 3D printing them reduce the cost in the future? Because I...
3D printing, I think, is a really big can of worms. I think right now, with what's available, there's some things that it could be really good for. In terms of, like, a full leg, the materials that they're printing in just aren't good enough yet. They're not strong enough. They're not approved to be used every day. I mean, that, like, there are covers that are being done that are 3D printed. The ones actually that I showed you are not even printed. They're laser cut from, like, an ABS plastic. But, like, maybe, eventually, hopefully, I think that's the idea. Because, of course, yeah, it would be great to have something that's going to be much lower cost. And you, like, I guess we're seeing some startups being done overseas in countries that are not able to have full labs. So it's kind of getting there, but even those devices are not always going to be, like, to the quality and not going to be tested to the point of, like, the materials that we're using right now. So that's sort of the answer.
The reason why I asked is, you know, my friend has a 3D printing And we're making kind of like miniature like homes for dogs.
Cool. Yeah.
And the materials are super strong.
Yeah.
You know, and we built like a wrench and other tools to build that.
Right. So yeah.
So I'm building nails as well. So it's like they're kind of like rubber nails. But they're really, really hard.
Okay.
And so I was wondering like if we could do that there, maybe like it's possible to bring that technology here.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So it's not. I mean, it's not super expensive, but it is definitely expensive. But
yeah.
I think making that is way more expensive than having 3D printing.
Yeah. I mean, like it boils down to the insurance coverage as well, so that plays a factor into it, which is also going to be different province to province. And like, I don't know, we can definitely chat in more detail later. I mean, we do have something on the go right now working with the engineering department at MUN. Oops, sorry. To work on 3D printed hand. So there is stuff on the go, but it's still very much in like a prototype stage. And it also, it seems like it would be more supplementary to their normal everyday hand. Like, it's just like, they, I don't know, they feel like Kinder Surprise toys. Like the plastic just, it's not there. Yeah.
I look at a lot of 3D printing websites, and you can readily see artificial limbs. They're usually the shells, as you say. And apropos Penny's question, they are often not realistic at all. They'll be sort of filigree, see-through leg, things like that.
Yeah.
Some people, but those are obviously interesting things. I mean, I have no idea how common that is because they're obviously selling 3D printing for everything they can. It's usually much more expensive, particularly for making something big, than doing it some other way.
Yeah.
And it's not the sort of thing, at least in the current situation, that you're going to be making buckets of Barbie dolls and things like that with. But the advantage of it is you can measure somebody or scan somebody or and personalize. So for things that are, you know, one or a few, small series or something, you know, a few of something, that could be cheaper than what's in the second book.
Yeah. I mean, from what we've come across so far, even just the printing time itself is incredibly long. Like, I think we even had an estimate of, like, was it like 10 hours? 10 hours,
yeah.
Right, for one piece. And to fabricate devices, I mean, sometimes we can get something start to finish done in that amount of time. I mean, and it's also, you know, of course, you're factoring in how you're used to working. The learning curve involved in learning new software could take longer and that sort of a thing. But I think a big issue that, and why I think a lot of people in prosthetics tend to sort of roll their eyes at the 3D printing suggestions and, like, you know, of course, like, there's amazing stuff online, but it's they're sidestepping the entire industry, which I think is where a lot of the problem is coming from, is that anybody who 3D prints something thinks that they can get away with fabricating these devices, but they're not consulting the people who have trained and learned how to do that properly and safely. So I think it's going to be more about trying to work together and collaborate and take, you know, the best of somebody who has that material knowledge and design and fabrication knowledge, and then working with somebody who knows how to assess the patient and fit them and make a device that's actually going to be properly functional to them. Like, I think that's where we have to go, is to have a lot of dialogue instead of sort of these little things popping up independently. Because I think that's already what's happening, and then people wonder why it's not already being done. And it's not being done yet because it's not working. So I think that there's a lot of conversation about this, and that we're at a really interesting point where technology is friggin' everywhere and everyone has access to it in different ways, but they also always think that they're the expert on it. So, you know, trying to keep ego out of it and trying to just really look at, okay, what are we trying to accomplish, and finding the best people to do that and have that conversation is, like, I think what's going to actually push us forward to make things that are going to be practical and accessible. So, yeah, like, I'd love to keep chatting about this. I feel like maybe I'll just grab another question. Yeah.
I was just wondering, because you said, do you see this as a creative process? Like, you were saying that you just problem solve and just grab anything that you have. Do you think of your work as, like, really inherently creative? That you see, like, you're an artist, but then you do this work that you are totally useful to you in that work?
Yeah.
Do you see it as a creative process?
I think it's... Like, it's funny because it is still my 9-to-5, you know? And I think that something about prosthetics over orthotics, which we do learn at school, which is making braces, like, I was much more drawn to this in the way that we use material. So I do find it kind of sculptural in a way. And there is a little bit of shaping and a little bit of, like, again, manipulating materials in a way that's satisfying. But it is for a very specific end product. So it's not necessarily, I guess, creative in the way that I find making jewelry to be, because I have sort of the ultimate freedom with that. But I think it's still playing with, you know, how, like, I find the problem solving creative as well, even though it's very specific and much more sort of mechanically driven. And I think I also just take a lot of pride in what I make. So to be able to still make something that, like, I'm happy with, hopefully the patient's going to be happy with as well, is satisfying for like a 9-to-5. But yeah, it's different, but there's a little bit of crossover. But yeah, I've totally actually been asked that before, and it's a good question, and I think something that I also kind of come back to as well. Yeah, thanks. I'll go this side of the room.
I guess my question was almost sort of yours. I was wondering, given your background in the aesthetic side of things, and sort of talking about having to almost compromise form for function, would you consider in the future sort of marrying two things, given your experience that you will be in the industry?
Yeah.
Are you sort of considering still applying that to your artistic life and bringing those forms into just super creative space and making things that are not necessarily beautiful, not necessarily functional, like you see on, you know, Ms. Lanesta or something like that?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you know, what, do you feel like you have to draw a line somewhere, or do you see yourself sort of expanding, using those skills to expand your own creative process?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think my manager would be really happy if I did that during work hours. But on my own time, yeah, for sure. And actually, I had a friend from my jewelry class. She came by last summer, and we were kind of just dived right into this conversation. And she said something really that really stuck with me, which was basically, like, you can, you know, you don't necessarily have to have your jewelry influence your prosthetic work, because that is still, it can still be sort of this independent little bubble, but you can let prosthetics influence your jewelry. So I think that's definitely the way that I can now shift it, and I can take this experience, and even, you know, going through school for a couple of years and working for a couple of years, I'm already starting to look back at jewelry that I made a few years ago and, like, reanalyze, like, why did I do that? Like, why did I make it that way? So, you know, even though I see this as, like, you know, learning these skills to make this thing, and, you know, again, it's kind of mechanical, which I wasn't used to working in that kind of way at all, that's influencing, like, a creative process now, which is kind of neat. So yeah, I think that's what I'd like to start doing, just in my own time, is, like, making work that can still blur all of the lines together. Yeah, and I'm sort of influenced by all of that influence.
Yeah.
used artificial body parts without replacing anything?
Oh yeah. Oh man. Like, well, not for what I see day to day, but like in art for sure. Yeah. I mean, of course, I didn't have any good examples, but like I just remember coming across. I think it's Rebecca Horn who was working. She did a lot of sort of body performance work, and she had these crazy like long arm things. And there's photographs of this. It's the 70s, so you know she's everything's very epic. But her like walking through big fields and like big headpieces, and like there's a lot of. I'll send you some images. I have a whole bunch saved on my computer. But yeah, there's definitely, I think, a lot of people interested in more of an additive process instead of just, yeah, that sort of reductive way. But yeah, totally, yes.
I have one.
Yeah.
What's your favorite prosthetic limb that you created?
I don't know. They're all the same, but they're all different, if that makes sense. Like, the process always feels similar, but then everyone kind of, like, has its own problem or issue or whatever with it. Making that cosmetic cover on this leg. Oh, wrong way. Whoop. And I did do her socket as well. That was really satisfying. I actually went back and modified it afterwards. We made some adjustments. And so being able to work with the patient at that point too was really nice because, again, like I don't always have that face-to-face interaction. And it's kind of funny that like I could make a leg start to finish never seeing the patient ever because I'm working off of casts and measurements and conversation as well with my coworkers. But this one was nice because I didn't even have to... Like, I could just, like, grab her and be like, hey, what do you think of this? Like, what, you know, let's go. Let's just chat this out. And so that was really satisfying. Yeah.
I'll stop it here, but Megan's going to stick around, and she has all of these prostheses.
Yeah.
Yeah, here. And she's very gently offered to stick around and ask, be available for questions after, well, now.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank Megan again for... sharing your knowledge and expertise with us tonight. I'd also really like to thank Assistant Director Chloe Edbrook for bringing Megan and Anna Hawkins together. She organized this. Thank you very much, Chloe. There's also a donation pot at the front, and this is to acknowledge the time that Megan, she's here as a volunteer, so if anyone wanted to drop some change in, just to acknowledge the time that Megan has taken out of her 9-to-5 to share her ideas and expertise with us tonight. So thank you all very much for coming. The bar is open, and like I said, we're sticking around for a little while, so you don't have to rush out, and Megan is around for more questions.
Not going anywhere.
Yeah. Thank you.